I have a slightly old-fashioned anecdote to tell you to get us started. Increasingly, of course, our book recommendations come either from bestseller lists or sometimes friends, but mostly from those dreadful digital incursions where, hello, Sarah, you like this, you'll like this.
Yes,
mine came from my local country library.
Really?
The best possible way to hear about a book from an enthusiastic librarian.
That's wonderful.
We're talking today because I'm doing a piece to some extent related to Halloween, only in the sense that it is hard to keep Halloween and witches apart. But my real interest in talking to you about your lovely book, Catherine, was that so many of its premises I thought were really interesting and engaging. It's called The Physic Book of Deliverance Dane, and I'm wondering if you could tell me first just what the inspiration for it was.
Well, it happened. The inspiration for it started a few years ago. I was studying for my PhD in American Studies at Boston University, and the midpoint of a PhD is a very large, intimidating exam. And so I was preparing for this large, intimidating exam. And the only way that I could really distract myself from how anxious I was to start telling myself some stories. And as it happened, my husband and I had moved to Marblehead, Massachusetts, which is one town over from Salem. And the thing that's interesting about Marblehead, there are a number of things interesting about it, but it has one of the largest collections of extant 18th century houses in the entire country. And this is because for most of its life, Marblehead was a pretty poor fishing village. And so whereas other New England towns, when they made money in the 19th century, tore their old architecture down, Marblehead's just stayed there. So on the one hand, I was living in this incredibly evocative 18th century town. And on the other, I was living right next door to modern-day Salem, Massachusetts, which today, if you go and visit Salem, it is a lot of fun, especially around Halloween time. But I was very intrigued by the fact that the way that witches and witchcraft is represented in Salem today, which is to say with the pointy hats and, you know, black cats and broomsticks and all that fun stuff, I was very intrigued by the fact that our understanding of witchcraft today, or what a witch is very different. In fact, bears practically no resemblance to the way that the early New Englanders actually understood witchcraft to be. So I was really struck by the paradox that here we were living in this part of the world where for generations upon generations, people had believed that witchcraft was actually real. And yet we've kind of forgotten what they thought it looked like and how they thought that it worked. And so the original sort of impetus for the story in The Physic Book of Deliverance Dane was, if magic were real the way the Salem villagers understood it to be, rather than the way we think of it today, how would it look, and who would do it, and why would they do it? What if one of the Salem witches were the real thing?
And what, in fact, did you decide was the answer to that question? What sort of characteristics did you want to give, not only, of course, Deliverance herself, but her modern descendants? What seemed to you to be the essence of witchcraft as you saw it in those terms?
Well, most people who were accused as witches in the 17th century were accused not because of anything that they did. They didn't do anything wrong, and there wasn't any sort of witchcraft as practice in quite the same way that we think of it today. I think today we think of it sometimes as an alternative religion. Certainly a number of people identify as witches today and treat it as an alternative religion. In the 17th century in New England, there wasn't really a world outside of Christianity. And so I started out by thinking about the fact that most people who were accused as witches were accused because they were the wrong kind of person. So a typical witch would be a woman, usually, who was argumentative, who was problematic, who maybe struggled with anger, or who was in some other way kind of out of step with her culture for one reason or another. And there's another kind of leaf to this idea, and that is that for the most part we assumed, because of the extremity or the extreme form of the Puritan religion, we assumed for a long time, we being historians, that there wasn't much in the way of folk magic belief or practice in 17th century New England. And it turns out that that's actually a little bit untrue. There was a tradition in early modern England, which was called the cunning folk tradition, which is to say that there would be someone in your village who could help you out with occult problems. So some of the most common things that your cunning person who would help you out with would be like dowsing for water. Where do you decide to dig a well? This is a very important question. Another really common one was conjuring to find lost objects, because in a time of scarcity and without a regular old police force that you can just call up, the loss of objects was actually a pretty intense problem. And then the other common sort of occult problem that your average early modern English villager might run into was unbewitching. Because in a time before the scientific revolution, when there wasn't a real clear understanding of the causes of disease, health and questions of the body and of health and of household affairs weren't entirely well understood from a scientific standpoint. And so bewitchment or cursing was one kind of common cause that was blamed for unfortunate things happening to a family. So there is some evidence that this idea, this cultural concept of the cunning person, persisted in an incomplete form in New England as well. And it really heavily informed the idea of what a witch might be, because, of course, the word cunning in English is a very specific word. It means smart and capable, but it also means sneaky and maybe a little bit underhanded. And so I took these two ideas, the idea of a witch being someone who's problematic in her culture, and then I took the idea of the cunning person and kind of blended them together to see what I could come up with for the Physic Book of Deliverance Day.
One of the things I thought was very striking is that right from the very beginning you topple one's expectations. The minute I looked at it, I understood what the likely setup was going to be when you get to that opening chapter and she's healing somebody's child. And I thought, oh, I know what's going to happen here. It's going to go wrong, and he's going to accuse her of being a demon, as indeed comes to be the case. But of course, the first thing you read next is she's suing him for slander. And
yeah.
I thought, is she crazy? Who would want to make that kind of trouble for herself? Well, Oscar Wilde did this, and it did not come out well.
No. Well, this is the interesting thing. So one of the ways that historians try to figure out how widespread the idea of witchcraft was, there are a couple of ways that we can do it. And of course, our records from that time period are not perfect. So the obvious way, if someone is accused as a witch, is if they show up in the legal system being accused of witchcraft, because, of course, witchcraft was a crime in early modern New England. It was a capital crime, which sounds a little bit like an obvious point, because, of course, you can't have a witch trial if it's not against the law. But I actually think that it's an interesting point, because we don't bother to pass laws against things that we don't believe are real. It kind of underscores the fact that witchcraft was a going concern in the intellectual and spiritual landscape of early modern New England. But you were only accused of witchcraft if your reputation had really just gone off the deep end. I mean, it was kind of, because it was a capital crime, it was very much a very serious development if someone were ultimately accused as a witch. And so another way that historians have learned to identify who maybe was suspected of being a witch, but maybe there wasn't enough information or they couldn't quite be brought to trial for it, is if you look at records of slander trials. Because being a witch or being thought a witch was so incredibly dangerous to an individual in a community that was very small, very insular, and very much dependent on relationship between neighbors. So if you were being gossiped about as a witch, it was very, very important to try to defend your reputation. And so sometimes someone who was being gossiped about would sue the person who was gossiping for slander. And so you can kind of see the extent to which someone might have had a questionable reputation if they're trying to regain control of their reputation in the court system. And so a few people who were accused during the Salem Panic, we actually have seen evidence of them in legal records from well before 1692 because they've had bad reputations. Either they were accused of witchcraft earlier, or more frequently, they show up in court records for arguing with their neighbors, for quarreling, suing people for slander, things like this. The early modern New Englanders were really litigious people, and so you can get a really incredible picture of their day-to-day lives and quarrels by looking at early legal records.
Now, the way you structured the book, that's clearly how you got a good deal of the information you used to create the construct, but then you actually allow Connie to go through the same process, so there's a parallel plot here. She, as a scholar, she's trying to track down this book, and I'd like to talk in a little more detail about your concept of the book. But then at the same time, we, more than she, knows that she herself is a witch and is coming to understand that. The book has so many dualities. There are two time frames. There are two kinds of discovery going on at the same time.
One thing that I was sort of attracted by was I think a lot of us like to think that we haven't fully uncovered all of our abilities in any given realm. I mean, in some respect, that is kind of the goal of any kind of academic inquiry, is the idea that we can acquire knowledge that we haven't had and therefore come to a fuller understanding of the world around us and of ourselves. And so with the protagonist, Connie Goodwin, in Physic Book of Deliverance Dane, she is a young academic, and she thinks of herself in these various sort of hard and fast academic terms. And I really wanted the real structure of the story to be about Connie coming into a better understanding of herself and of her place in the world. And so I was attracted by the idea of, what if you were a witch and you didn't know it? What if you had a pet, for instance, that you thought was a pet, but maybe it wasn't a pet in the traditional sense? And so part of it is, it's true that we as readers, we have a kind of greater insight into what's happening around the protagonist than the protagonist does herself. And part of the pleasure, I hope, is in watching her kind of catch up with what we know is going to happen.
In a post-feminist age, it's hard not to see witches as, to some extent, symbols of female empowerment that has been in some way curtailed or sidelined or undiscovered. Do you feel that you're also writing to some extent in that tradition?
Well, definitely it's impossible to talk about witches either in history or I think in the present without talking about gender and talking about women more specifically. And particularly when we consider that in many cases in early modern New England, the reason that someone would be accused as a witch is because they weren't conforming to their appropriate role, their appropriate gender role. They were maybe trying to claim too much power for themselves or trying to express too much anger. And I think that a lot of us today maybe identify with the witch as a trope because of the kind of contested nature of gender continuing today. I mean, even today, women are not really permitted, socially speaking, to be angry, to express anger. And that was one of the most salient character flaws that your average witch would have. And so I definitely wanted, with Physic Book, to open an avenue for conversation, not only about the ways that gender either enables or constrains us, but also to open a conversation about our own expectations for ourselves, about what maybe has changed over time and maybe what hasn't changed over time for women.
The other real character in this book is, of course, the Physic Book itself. Can you talk a little bit about how you came to that concept and what traditions it reflects?
Yes, well, the sort of driving engine of the story in Physic Book of Deliverance Dane is, as you glean from the title, a physic book, and that's P-H-Y-S-I-C-K. So physic is an old English word that means medicine. And of course, in the 1600s and 1500s, the border between what is medicine, what is folk remedy, and what is foodstuff is actually a fairly hazy border. So, in fact, we think of these as being very distinct categories today, but even today we kind of don't have that much distinction between them. I'll give you an example. Chamomile tea. When you have a cold, everyone says you should drink chamomile tea. I hate chamomile tea. I feel like it doesn't taste like anything, and yet I drink it whenever I have a cold. And the question is chamomile tea a beverage? Is it a medicine? Or is it an artifact within our culture which says that it is going to be effective for me? Is it a belief, in effect? And so I was intrigued by that kind of confusion of category. And if you look at the early modern period, there is evidence of there being manuals or handbooks that were written to help young women who were about to be married learn how to maintain a household. And these handbooks would include such vitally important bits of information as how to make jellied eel, very important if anyone's about to get married, to be able to make jellied eel. But it might also include how to make a poultice if in the event of a burn. Or it might include how to make a beverage if you come down with a cold. And so I was intrigued by the idea of this kind of gendered set of knowledge, in effect, which is another kind of overarching sub-theme in Physic Book of Deliverance Dane, the idea that we have their bodies of knowledge which are valued differently according to who possesses them. And so that's something I was exploring a little bit with the idea of the Physic Book. So there is such a thing as a Physic Book, but of course the borderline between what you're liable to find in it is subject to some imagination.
And in the more traditional realm of fantasy literature, its parallel is what's generally called, I believe, a Book of Shadows.
Yes.
So that were you also looking at the literary tradition that you could draw on for what would happen if you wanted to extend the identity of this quite historic idea into something that was a little more fantastical?
Yes. Well, not only in fantasy literature, but actually in the modern-day practice of Wicca, as I understand it. Modern-day practitioners of Wicca keep a Book of Shadows, which is, as far as I can understand, is a sort of journal, mainly of thoughts, but also of practices or ideas or observations. And so I was very intrigued by the idea that we still, in our culture, possess this sense of a book which can contain secret knowledge that is passed from person to person, in a sort of a repository of thoughts and practices and things learned. And so with the idea of the Physic Book, I was very much trying to tangle together both the historical idea of a Physic Book and also the more modern idea.
There's a lot of romance in this book, but it's not of the traditional sort. It's a slow burn.
There is some romance in the book. Connie, over the course of the story, meets a young guy named Sam who's working as a steeplejack. And I thought it was kind of important that Connie have someone in her life that will bring her out of her head, because she is an academic, she's a bit of an intellectual, she's a little bit out of touch with the physical world around her, you know, and we see this in the way that she dresses and the way that she's kind of indifferent to her surroundings in some regard. And she needs someone in her life who's going to make her more curious and who's going to make her kind of question some of the assumptions that she has about the world around her, someone who's a little more credulous. And so Sam, who is a steeplejack that she meets by accident, becomes that voice of curiosity, kind of urging her to question what she has long assumed to be true, both about the world and also about herself.
I don't remember whether there's a moment in the book where we realize that she must be Deliverance's descendant, that it comes out as clearly as that, but it's obvious at some point that both her grandmother and her mother were also witches. It's very tantalizing the way the mother doesn't yield up much information to her. Is it because Connie needs to arrive at the right moment to understand all of this? Tell me a little bit about how you staged that.
Well, one thing that I've long been interested in is that we are all of us individuals, we're kind of our moment in time. You know, I happen to have been born in the late 70s, and so I grew up in a world without the internet and without email. I am a woman of my own specific moment in time, and it's very different from people who are even only 5 years younger than me. And so with Connie and her mother, I mean, one of the great central themes of Physic Book is the relationship between mothers and daughters, who in some respect are all variations on the same woman, except that, as most of us who are mothers and daughters are, in some respect, variations on the same woman, but we are of our different moments in time. So Connie's mother, her name is Grace, She is very much a child of the 60s. She sort of had a commune period, and she kind of is very, very involved in the New Age. She is a baby boomer in the kind of ultimate sense. And so I was intrigued by the idea that you can be variations on the same kind of woman and trying to communicate with each other, but unable to make yourselves understood because of the language that you're using and the sets of assumptions that are in place. You can speak across purposes. And so sometimes people say, well, why didn't Grace just come right out and say something to Connie? Well, if you look through the book, you see that Grace does say things to Connie. It's just that she is saying it in her particular idiom of her particular moment in time. And Connie's not understanding what she's saying because Connie belongs to a very different moment in time. Connie is approaching these ideas with different sets of assumptions. And that's something that we see echoed in all of the kind of mother-daughter relationships over time. You see that that's true of the women in the historical portion of the story, as well as on the women in the modern portion of the story. And so a lot of the book is very interested in ideas about language and the way that we try to make ourselves understood to each other and how that can actually be a startlingly difficult thing to do.
Does that make the book important in another way? It's one of the things that links all of them. It has its own identity and language, and it's something they can all access.
Yes, in some respects that's true. I mean, I think that we rely on books for that kind of thing, actually, to serve as repositories of knowledge that hopefully we'll be able to transcend whatever moment that produced them. And with a book like a physics book that is marked in and transformed and changed by people over successive generations, you have this this idea of a consistency over time that might not be available in any other context.
Now, I know that you're writing a new book. Is it a continuation of this story, or is it going in a different direction? I'm just imagining Connie writing her own recipes down.
Well, the next one is my next novel, which is coming out on May 1st, is going to be called The House of Velvet and Glass. And it is not a direct continuation of the story in physic book, although I have an idea in the back of my head for a physic book continuation, which I'm going to start working on soon. The House of Velvet and Glass is its own story, but it's the same kind of genre as physic book, which is to say historical fiction with a kind of unexpected magical twist. And it is going to be set in Boston in 1915, about a Boston family who has lost some members on the Titanic in 1912 and then has been caught up in the world of seances. And there's sort of a mystery that has to be solved at the center of it as well.
Well, that, of course, is extremely timely. We're coming up to the 100th anniversary of the sinking of the Titanic.
We are, which was a complete serendipitous accident when I started working on it. I've been working on the book for a number of years now, and I only sort of gradually figured out that, oh, look at that, it's going to be the centennial.
Just to return for a moment to physic book, two things that are particularly notable, of course, is that you yourself are the descendant of two witches, at least in the Salem witch trial sense. At what point in this process did you discover that?
Well, I actually had learned that when I was a teenager. We had an old family genealogy that had been kicking around, and my father's sister was adding to it and discovered that we had these witches on the family tree. And it, in truth, wasn't a total shock, given that one of them is Elizabeth Howe, who has the same last name that I do. And so they're fairly distant. They're on the great aunt level of relationship. But as you can imagine, being a teenager with a slightly dark bent, my first thought was, oh, that is the coolest thing I've ever heard. But more importantly than that, I think, is all of us can identify with Salem in a broader sense. I mean, it is such a troubling and overarching moment in American historical culture that I think any of us can kind of identify with feeling marginalized or judged by your community. And the idea that there were 19 people who were put to death by the state for being the wrong kind of person is a truly chilling idea, and very much at odds with some of the ideals that I think we hold in common in our culture today. And I think that's one of the reasons that Salem continues to fascinate, that we're never fully done with Salem.
And, of course, it became the model for Arthur Miller's The Crucible and, as you say, seems to be an interesting and disturbing template for those ideas of our inability to absorb certain kinds of people in our community. And a slightly perhaps less grave but interesting development in your book is that you're familiar as a dog and not a cat. Was there an historical basis for finding a dog familiar?
There was, as a matter of fact. If you look at the records from the Salem trial, there's a lot of talk of animal familiars. And animal familiars, which of course in modern contemporary popular culture we pair a witch in our minds with a black cat, I think most frequently. Animal familiars were understood to be spirits that kind of were in attendance on a given witch and would do its bidding or do its mischief. And if you look at the Salem papers, there's a lot of talk of familiars, but generally not of cats. There's a lot of mention of yellow birds. There's one mention of a snake. There's something small like a cat, but bright red. And then there are also a number of mentions of dogs. So I was sort of attracted to the idea of that, both because it's a little bit unexpected. It's different from what we historically have thought of with witches, but also because of animals I have known. I feel like a cat is less likely to want to do your bidding for you. I feel like a cat isn't actually going to be a very effective familiar, whereas a dog, he seems like he's going to be very loyal and attentive, but he's also going to make sure that if he's given the opportunity to steal the cheese, he will. So I felt like a dog would make a pretty mischievous and appropriate familiar for my character.
And he seems to be a kind of lumpen terrier type. Was he drawn on any acquaintance of yours?
I plead the fifth on that one, she said, looking over at the sofa where her terrier was fast asleep.
There's a very touching moment at the end when you get the sense that Arlo, too, has been passed down in the family, that he is still loyally guarding Deliverance's graveside when he's not being of service to Connie.
Mm-hmm. Well, a number of readers have written and asked me, Is there just one dog? Because at various different moments in the course of the story, we see a dog sort of appear in various different shapes or sizes or degrees of importance. And I think I'd like to stay mum on that one. I think that's the kind of thing that is more enticing for readers to decide for themselves.
Well, you know that the American Kennel Club has a breed site where you get to read up on the potential characteristics of dogs you might like to own. Perhaps the terrier clubs could now add, possibly extremely useful as a familiar. The other source I thought you might be familiar with, as you may know, there's a not entirely well-known but recently revived Jacobean play called The Witch of Edmonton, apparently also based on a real Elizabethan trial in that period.
I am familiar with it. I haven't actually read the play, but I know of it, and I actually know a bit of the of some of the cases that it's based on. There's some fascinating witch cases, especially from the area around East Anglia, in the UK, which is where a number of settlers for that one small county in Massachusetts came from. And it's kind of enticing to see the way that that culture can transport and persist. It's pretty intriguing.
And she very much accords with all of the things that you've outlined. She was an outsider, she was poor, she was angry and disorderly. But the devil, because of course this is a contemporary playwright who very much believes in the concept of demonism, the devil comes to her in the form of a dog.
Yes. Well, there's a long-standing tradition, of course, a dog being the guardian of the gates of hell as well. Mm-hmm. And what's intriguing, actually, is not everyone during the early modern period believed wholeheartedly in witches. In fact, one of the most famous or best-known skeptics at this time period was a guy named Reginald Scott. And Reginald Scott was writing in the 16th century, and one of his complaints is, why do we always assume that entering into a pact with the devil, who promises you fine things and lots of power, and yet all the people that we accuse of having entered into a pact and being given lots of power, wouldn't they all be young and wealthy and successful? But instead, they tend to be old and poor and kind of miserable creatures. And so Reginald Scott makes a pretty very modern-seeming case about the kind of irrationality of witchcraft accusations.
One other point I wanted to touch on is there seems to be a kind of critical mass, or possibly witches just seem to come in cycles as characters of interest. There is recently, of course, a new television series called The Secret Circle, in which there are teenagers who discover that there are witches. But I was particularly interested in the fact that Deborah Harkness's book, A Discovery of Witches, has some similarities to yours in that she posits a charmed volume of some kind, in this case from the alchemical tradition. And I was wondering if you feel that there's just something in the air at the moment that drove the two of you to look at this subject in such interesting ways, also from scholarly contexts.
Well, it is an interesting question, and I think that there's been kind of a generalized sort of surge in witch-related writing. There's also The Heretic's Daughter, which came out about a year before me, and of course The Lace Reader by Salem author Brunonia Berry. And I think it's hard for me to conclude exactly why it might be, because of course I am within my culture. I cannot see out of my culture, and so it's hard for me to come up with a specific answer. But I do know that we live in a time of great fear and uncertainty. And if you look at other moments in history when Salem in particular has had a real kind of resonant effect, I mean, you mentioned Arthur Miller earlier. Arthur Miller, of course, was writing in the 1950s, and his play, The Crucible, is most usually considered to be an allegory for anxiety about communism in American culture. And in fact, The Crucible was being performed on Broadway on the very night that Ethel and Julius Rosenberg were executed for conspiracy to commit espionage. They were the couple who was accused of spying and giving the secret of the atomic bomb to the Russians.
Oh, my.
And so there is this moment, I think, in the 1950s about anxiety. Who can we trust? Who is who they say they are? And who isn't who they say they are? And I think it's maybe not too much of a leap to think that we've been in a moment like that in our culture for a few years now. How do we know if we're safe? And so if I had to hypothesize, I would guess that witches still play that role in American culture today, that they still kind of raise questions about what is safety and what is security and who is trustworthy and how can we be in control of our environment. And so I think that's probably something to do with it. Or it could just be that witches are a lot of fun.
With or without pointy hats.
With or without pointy hats.